Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the HTI-1 Proposed Rule Task Force. I'm Mike Berry with ONC, and I'd like to thank you for joining us today. I'd also like to send a special thanks to our guest presenters today, that being we have several ONC program leads with us today, and also some external SMEs that have joined us, and we're looking forward to hearing from them. All of our task force meetings are open to the public, and your feedback is welcomed, which could be typed in the Zoom chat feature throughout the meeting, or could be made verbally during the public comment period that is scheduled toward the end of our meeting. I'd like to begin roll call of our task force members, so when I call your name, please let us know that you are here. And I'll start with our co-chairs and Group 3 lead, Stephen Lane.
Good morning and welcome, everyone.
Steve Eichner.
Good morning and welcome.
Hung Lu.
Good morning.
Hans Butendeck will be joining us a little bit later. Clint McDonald. Reese Sundar-Rajan and Phil Sutherland.
Good morning.
Good morning to all. Now, please join me in welcoming Stephen Lane, Steve Eichner, and Hung Lu for their opening remarks.
Hung, you want to take it from here?
Sure. Welcome, everyone, to the final stretch of our work reviewing the gathering and reviewing the request for information for the ONC new published rule. And I'm really excited about this session because we have a full slate of speakers that will be educating everyone on pharmacy interoperability functionality. And I think we'll get a lot of good information that we can incorporate into the into the recommendations. Also, we have some speakers from the ONC as well as outside speakers to speak on the clinical decision support CDS hooks. And finally, we hope to have some public comment from you to help inform us on how best to move forward with the recommendations for this. Over to you, Stephen, all right?
Well, thank you so much, Hung. So again, we're looking forward to these presentations and don't want to dilly-dally in getting to them. It sounds like we might be missing Alex Baker for the moment. So Carmen, I don't know if you can tag team and switch things with him, or we'll hopefully he'll show up here in the next couple of minutes. Let's go to the next slide and just quickly review the charge of our task force. These next two slides outline that charge. Most of you have seen this before, but essentially we are here to provide feedback on the various components of the HTI-1 proposed rule. On the next slide, you can see that today we're focusing on soliciting feedback on requests for information related to program standards. That's where we will go with the decision support discussion. Next slide. These are the specific topics that were assigned to Group 3. As you can see, we're at the bottom of our list, having worked through the upper bullets. So we will proceed. Next slide. And that brings us to the first presentation, which we're very excited about. So Alex, are you here? Or Carmen, can you start?
Hey, yes, this is Alex Baker.
Oh, wonderful, you're here, great.
Yep. All right, hi everyone, thanks for having us. Let's go to the next slide. This is Alex Baker. I am the Federal Policy Branch Chief in the Regulatory and Policy Affairs Division in the Office of Policy, and joined here by Carmen Smiley to talk about the pharmacy interoperability RFI that we included in HTI-1. And here are some of the basic disclaimer and public comment guidance information. Next slide. Okay, so as folks may have seen, I have included a pretty significant RFI in this proposed rule around pharmacy interoperability. within the Health IT Certification Program. And I just want to lay out kind of the thinking behind how this is organized, and then we'll turn it over to Carmen for to review in a little bit more detail some of the questions that are in here. So this RFI has two sections. The first is questions related to a real-time prescription benefit certification criterion that we say that we are considering as something for the Health IT Certification Program. Just to recap for folks, and you know, this background is in the rule also, this sort of the immediate driver for this is a provision in the Consolidated Appropriations Act of 2021. This provision in the law required Part D to include real-time benefit tools as a requirement for those plans, which is something that Part D actually had already done in regulation in a 2019 rule, but the CAA reiterated that and then specified that the secretary must adopt a standard for real-time benefit tools as part of those requirements. Specific to ONC, this provision also amended the definition of a qualified electronic health record in the Public Health Service Act to say that a qualified electronic health record must include or be capable of including a real-time benefit tool. As folks may know, this is important because the qualified electronic health record definition in the Public Health Service Act is the original statutory provision that the current base EHR definition in regulation is based on. So when ONC defines the base EHR definition, that is how we continue to implement this original qualified electronic health record provision from the Public Health Service Act. And that means that based on this new statutory provision, we need to look at how we could include this real-time benefit tool functionality within what we define as the base EHR definition, and thus need to think about a certification criterion in the program that could be included there. So that is really the sort of immediate motivation to do this, that we have this statutory provision that we need to figure out how we are going to implement in coordination with the CMS folks at Part D that are also covered by this. So the first part of this RFI is really focused on that concept questions about how ONC should go about creating a criterion that could fulfill this. Specifically looks at an NCPDP standard, the real-time prescription benefit standard version 12 as a standard that could serve as the basis for this criterion. And that is also the standard that the Part D folks have proposed to adopt in their program in a rule at the end of last year. And this first section, as Carmen will go into in more detail, really looks at the specifics of that, asks questions about the standard and application of that so that we can hopefully better understand the public's views on these issues as we potentially develop such a criterion under future rulemaking. The second section of this RFI, wanted to really focus on this criterion and the how we could potentially implement this, but I think adding this criterion potentially to the certification program raises some other questions about the broader workflow around different pharmacy transactions and other issues around pharmacy and interoperability that are not necessarily already addressed in the certification program, or where we have done certain things but have not fully implemented it. And I think, you know, in questions about this criterion for us, we wanted to pair this with additional questions about related workflows, to what extent we should also consider including those within the program, and to what extent, you know, potentially including this real-time prescription benefit certification criterion would raise the need to implement, complementary policies to cover related transactions within the program. So those are kind of the two big sections of this that you will see in the proposed rule, and a little bit of the background for, why we are need to do this to implement the provision of statute. And with that, I will turn it over to Carmen Smiley to go through some more of the details of these two sections.
Carmen? Thanks, Alex. I'm sorry. I was just making sure I didn't interrupt anybody. Thank you so much. Next slide, please. My name is Carmen Smiley. I'm a senior health IT specialist in the Office of Technology at ONC, and I'm the technical lead for all of our pharmacy interoperability efforts, and I get to work with Alex on many of those, so really appreciate the intro. We're going to go into a little bit more detail on the specific questions that are asked throughout the RFI, and I'm not going to read the questions to you per se, but I'll touch on them and provide a little bit more context. But as you'll see, as we pose each of the questions and cover some of the major sections, we've done a great deal of research in this area before preparing the RFI, but you know, there's a lot we still don't know. So we really look forward to receiving comments from this group and from the public so that we are better informed and educated as to how best to potentially implement such a criterion. I'll start off with the potential transactions. In the RFI, of course, there's a great deal more detail, and I encourage everybody to read over the detail, but we provided a set of testing scenarios. And we're wondering if that initial set of testing scenarios that we've drafted would be really appropriate for a potential real-time prescription benefit criterion. Should we also cover other testing scenarios, or are there other testing considerations that we should take into account as we're considering moving forward? And finally, within this set of questions, we also are seeking more information on the value of negotiated price. Now, negotiated price was included in the appropriations language that Alex referred to earlier, but it is not currently supported by the NCPDP, a real-time prescription benefit standard. And so we're curious if it would bring value to patients and prescribers, or if there are other opinions or insights that the public could provide on that particular subject. We're also asking about the use of XML or EDI format. Because the standard that we are considering supports both formats, we want to hear from you if we should also require both formats, or one or the other, simply acknowledging that there are, you know, various areas across the industry that are more up to date, perhaps on XML, while perhaps other legacy systems are still actively using EDI formats for various purposes. Next slide, please. Thank you. We then go into a little bit more of the segment-based analysis of the standard and any capabilities that we should otherwise consider for the potential criterion. So as the NCPDP real-time prescription benefit standard supports both NDC and RX norm within the clinical segment, we're curious as to if we were to require both, if that would support the improved adoption, maintenance, and harmonization between these two very different code sets, as we've heard, you know, concerns from the public and through the comment collection process and from the HITACH on concerns regarding that harmonization and alignment, also for not just for real-time prescription benefit, but for other areas that may affect pharmacy interoperability, including electronic prescribing. would by requiring demonstration. So what, from the certification perspective, what we do is develop requirements. So that requires health IT developers to demonstrate their capacity to support certain areas or, you know, certain aspects of the standard. And you know, acknowledging that the standard itself was developed to allow for situational support should that information be available. So, you know, would requiring this for the potential criteria that we're discussing today, would it bring other benefits to healthcare providers or any other participants that support the transactions across the ecosystem? Would requiring both also, you know, impose undue burden on developers or, you know, or others, anybody who may be seeking certification to the potential criterion? Or would each independently provide sufficient information for various applications and various exchange partners to be able to process and exchange all of the information that they are sending and receiving? Or what would be the consequences of establishing as recommended by the HITECH sort of RX norm as the single source? This was a previous recommendation by the HITECH. There may be more updated recommendations, but I think this is a very, this is an area of interest to many on the call, and we really look forward to receiving comment on these, and we'd love to hear more about real world experience in both. Next slide, please. Also in the clinical segment we're moving on to is that we're curious if we should one, require the clinical segment, which is currently optional within the standard, and within that clinical segment, should we require demonstration of both ICD-10 and SNOMED CT as part of the certification criteria, simply to support more seamless, you know, partially to support more seamless transition between ICD-10 and ICD-11 when that time arrives, or perhaps there are other benefits to requiring both. Of course, we are always interested if any requirements may impose any undue burden on developers, and we're really looking for in what ways in which, you know, we can bring the greatest value to patients and prescribers through implementation of our certification program. Next slide, please. Thank you. I'm also ONC subject matter expert in patient identity and matching, and so I can't help but see you know, through that lens anytime in, you know, in almost all of my work. And I think that it's widely known that you know, the success of any patient matching and record linkage implementation for real-time prescription benefit is incredibly critical, because without that patient-specific information, as I'm stressing, that we really need for this to be successful. And many times that matching is occurring both within the health IT plus across exchange partners. And this has been an ongoing challenge for many years. There have been great successes, but additional work is certainly welcome. And so what we are curious about, what we would like to hear from the public on specifically is if, what about the potential of expanding the number of patient demographics that would otherwise map to the NCPDP script standard, which is a far more comprehensive list of demographics that could potentially be leveraged for patient matching both within and between systems. Currently, the NCPDP real-time prescription benefit standard contains a much more condensed version of the available demographics that may be relied on. And we realize also that more information doesn't necessarily translate to greater success, but it could help in ways that we may not exactly foresee. So we would love to hear any other insights or suggestions on how we could support accurate matching throughout the ecosystem, especially to ensure that the proposed criterion makes the greatest impact. Next slide, please. System and workflow integration. So I think as we continue to consider the larger ecosystem of pharmacy interoperability, we want to ensure that as, you know, there may be potentially additional modules developed in the future, and there may be additional criterion within the pharmacy interoperability space, that would ideally work in tandem with each other in a way that supports each other in the way that is really seamless. And we hope to see this also that all pharmacy interoperability related criterion are always happening within the clinical workflow for prescribers, so that prescribers never have to leave the application that they're already using. They don't have to log into separate web-based platforms or other applications that might be tacked on to the system that they're accustomed to, but rather the seamless interchange of that data across applications so that experience for prescribers is also seamless. Next slide, please. We are also considering, and we'd love to receive additional comment on this regarding the scope of real-time prescription benefit and the potential criterion. And so, when we are, the standard itself actually supports the exchange of medications and vaccines and devices and supplies, but for an initial introduction of the potential criterion, should we limit that scope or should we expand it and really, start off with the full potential coming out of the gate as the criterion may be introduced to the certification program? We're also curious to hear about any additional burden that the full scope may impose on developers, or if additional development is needed within the standard to better support these various types of codified entries. Next slide, please. And this is actually more about the scope, really specific to devices or supplies. And as I'm sure many of you have observed over the years, there are times when criterion will also evolve over time as the industry evolves or as standards evolve. And so, if you feel that an iterative approach may be more prudent, we would also love to hear from you on that matter. And what additional opportunities might arise from requiring conformance to the NCPDP formulary and benefit standard, which is an additional standard that could be used to significantly support real-time prescription benefit. Now, ONC previously had a drug formulary criterion within the certification program, but a specific standard was not named at that time. That particular criterion was removed from the certification program after years because a drug formulary management was so ubiquitous across the industry. And we didn't see that it really brought any great value to requiring developers to test to something that they do every day. This is actually a much more advanced application of the formulary and benefit standard for this specific use case, much more advanced and perhaps much more supportive to the standard we are also considering. Next slide, please. I then go into a little bit more detail about formulary and benefit management, as I mentioned. And we really want to hear about some key benefits that providers may experience by having that standard available to them, and what processes that standard or additional processes that are currently under consideration or could be considered in the future through adoption of the formulary and benefit standard in conjunction with the real-time prescription benefit standard. Next slide, please. We also ask about the potential of incorporating electronic prior authorization transactions within the electronic prescribing certification criterion. And so this is slightly different, and that the majority of questions we're asking are about a potential criterion for real-time prescription benefit. Though, as I'm sure you already know, we already have an electronic prescribing criterion that is at B3 within the certification program. But we're wondering if we should update that criterion by requiring electronic prior authorization transactions. Those transactions are currently optional within the program. And so we do have the capacity to test for them already, though we do not require conformance to them yet. I know electronic prior authorization has been a hot topic on many of these discussions and across the industry. ONC is very interested in seeking ways in which we can better support this capability. All right, and then other certification approaches that are slightly more programmatic in nature, and that as we consider expanding pharmacy interoperability criterion within the program for additional capabilities and functionalities, potentially additional standards, you know, could we provide a bundled approach to testing more than one criterion within a single testing event? And so if you were a health IT developer, and you were seeking certification to both electronic prescribing and any other potential criteria that could be introduced, ideally we would be able to knock them all out within one testing event, because many of those processes are either work in tandem or they're interchangeable or much of the same data is used. And many of the standards that we are considering are already aligned, already easily map to each other because of the work done from, you know, standards development organizations like NCPDP over the years. Or if we were to propose any sort of a, you know, alternative testing approach that may support developers and may sort of streamline the testing experience, we're interested in hearing about any additional opportunities to reuse testing resources, especially. Next slide, please. And I believe this is the discussion area. I really appreciate the opportunity to present more about our RFI today, and we look forward to your questions.
This is Ike. I'm looking over our task force group to see if there are any questions from the group. Stephen, do you have anything?
No. I really appreciate those presentations. Carmen, as always, you're very clear and succinct. Really appreciate that. I think as soon as we can get into the SME presentations, really with a focus on developing specific recommendations. I've been drafting some member recommendations in our spreadsheet, tab 3, row 8, column G, and I invite work group members to do the same. If you have anything to add there, we again want to come out of this with any specific recommendations that we think would be valuable. I personally think that these are warranted, though in my case, it's really very supportive of the changes that Carmen laid out as possibilities.
And Carmen, Steve Eitner. I do have one question. One of the perpetual or long-term issues to me with prescriptions and medication lists and the like in EHRs seem to be issues related to medications that don't have NDC numbers, such as new medications, not repurposed medications that are in FDA clinical trials, or many medications that are being processed as compounded drugs, many of which are used for treating rare diseases or patients particular circumstances. I'm kind of wondering if there's an opportunity in the space of the questions ONC is asking, or the data tools that are available in the proposal, to do a better job of accommodating the exchange of those types of medications, because it's challenging for everybody. Providers don't end up with a consolidated list of medications that patients are actually taking. Patients don't end up with a consolidated list of drugs they're actually taking. And pharmacies don't end up with a comprehensive list of medications that a patient may be taking. And that, of course, runs into a bunch of issues looking at contraindications and things like that, because there isn't a consolidated list of everything that a patient may be consuming.
This is Carmen. Thank you so much for providing insight. And these are exactly the challenges we hope to address. And so currently for our electronic prescribing criterion, you may use codes other than Rx norm if that medication does not contain an Rx norm. And so those codes could include NDC, but we really want to hear from the industry on whether or not through this additional potential criterion for real-time prescription benefit, if that would better support some of the challenges that you're describing.
Thank you.
Hung, are you comfortable moving forward?
Yes, I would agree with moving forward with the subject matter expert presentations.
Hi, this is Margaret Weicker. I am Vice President of Standards Development at NCPDP, and I thought I would go first if Frank and Shelley don't mind.
Yeah, Margaret, I don't mind. This is Shelley. Go ahead.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So my first comment is NCPDP is obviously in support of the adoption of our real-time prescription benefit standard and the certification program that's being proposed and associated with that. We currently have one for the script standard, the e-prescribing, and feel that it's useful for that particular business function, and RTPP would be beneficial as well. The foundation, the NCPDP Foundation, sponsored a grant, and the John Hopkins Medical actually put the standard in place, ran it through its paces, and found that on average, it saved a patient $20.41. And it found that with the instance of one patient, it saved them over $1,000. So this is a tool that's implemented that has proven to be cost effective for the patient. So in response to a CMS Medicare Part D rule that was naming the real-time prescription benefit standard version 12, we asked that version 13 be adopted, which is the latest version of the standard. And our reasons why we wanted version 13 adopted. So we'll be providing those comments to the RFI. In regard to Rx norm and NDC codes, we sent a letter to HITECH. I know we carbon copied ONC, but NCPDP is opposed to the replacement or the secondary status of using NDC codes versus Rx norm. If you all would like, I can put the link of that letter in the chat and you can have that to review. So we'll be providing information, obviously, in the response to the RFI. In regard to EPA, we support the mandatory use of that in the script. E-prescribing certification, as Carmen mentioned, it's optional. The tool supports all of those transactions today. And we do have some companies, entities that have tested those transactions. But obviously not all, because it wasn't mandatory that they do that, but the tool exists today. XML versus EDI and supporting, you know, one, both. When we first put up the certification criteria for e-prescribing, it was the script standard and the version that was adopted had both the EDI syntax and the XML syntax. That would be version 10.6. And we had criteria that supported both. So I believe our recommendation will be that any kind of certification would need to support both. in regard to that, because we have entities, some that have implemented XML, some have implemented the EDI piece of it. So I think the certification should be both at this time. So in the interest of time, I'll turn it over to Frank and Shelley, and then I may come back on if we have some more time.
This is Shelley. I can go next. I just have a couple of comments, more from the clinical standpoint. The reason for NCPDP, for NDC and RX Norm to both be used is RX Norm is a higher level, similar to what you would see with a medication order or physician order. When you get to the NDC level, you're actually getting down to the product level, which is what was actually dispensed, or what is actually priced out from a particular manufacturer. So depending, it's important that we support both RX Norm and NDC, as Margaret had stated. Also, in the bidirectional type of communication, this is really important that the systems are able to understand the NDC as well as RX Norm, because as an example, if a medication is recalled, then you would have to know the actual NDC number of that particular medication. In terms of the products that don't have a code or might not have even a unique product identifier, there are processes that can be used to use a code that might represent it. I know that ICANN mentioned compounded type of items, and we try to get down to the actual products within those compounded items in terms of clinical trials and other areas. You're not really seeing electronic prescribing of investigational drugs or some others. I agree with Ike in terms of the medication list that this could be a potential problem, but these are somewhat unique situations. They might be more common in situations in hematology, oncology, or some of the other areas, but I think it's still important, it's my opinion, that we need to support both NDC and RX Norm, and there can be some mapping that can be done between the two, realizing that RX Norm is not as granular as NDC, and there are reasons for the use of NDC numbers, even in identifying which product has caused an adverse drug reaction. In terms of the workflow in real-time pharmacy benefit to leading to prior authorization, we believe that this can reduce burden both on the prescriber side as well as on the pharmacy dispensing side. If we know that the medication is in the formulary and what the patient will actually be taking, can lead to a reduction in prior authorizations, phone calls, faxes, and such. So we believe that it's important to move forward with using these standards that are out there, such as real-time pharmacy benefit, and also for prior authorizations. And I'll turn it over to Frank.
Great, thanks, Shelley. I can bring maybe more of an implementer's perspective to points that both Shelley and Margaret brought up, and then maybe a couple others. I mean, just to kind of finish the NDC versus RX Norm conversation, just from a testing and like creating a rule around this perspective, in the standard, both are available and compatible. So they both can be populated. NDC is required because typically for pharmacy benefit management systems, they operate at that level of a product. You know, they are pricing out or determining, you know, the patient's responsibility for a given product that will be dispensed for them. And so that's kind of the main frame of reference. But it's definitely possible to additionally send an RX Norm code. And so if the determination was that, you know, to support maybe downstream compatibility or other purposes, a certification rule could be added that doesn't, you know, conflict with any requirements of the standard itself. It would just add a certification requirement that sort of further defines what a submitter would need to populate. With regard to one of the points I don't think was brought up by Shelley or Margaret, the use of the patient segment in script, maybe in addition to or instead of what is in real-time benefit. Looking at the content of those, I think the, you know, the purpose would be key to consider when it comes to the patient content. So the real-time benefit transaction really uses the patient information simply to identify the patient characteristics, I guess, in addition to their member information, which is really primary in the process. So pharmacy benefit manager responding to the request will typically have kind of member identification information that serves to, you know, pull up the right record to determine their plan details, more so than doing demographic matching based on patient characteristics or their address. And so if the aim is to tighten up that matching process, you know, additional demographics may not, you know, have much of an effect, I guess, toward that. But one thing to call out is that, and I think we've, I don't know if we've talked about the real-time benefit version 13, which has come out since the time when I think initial recommendations for version 12 were made. Real-time benefit 13 has some additional features that I think are really beneficial to those that would be migrating from their current proprietary real-time benefit methods. And some additional things that would be helpful to support features in a response that a PBM might return. So when it comes to patient information, the real-time benefit 12 doesn't have any patient address or, you know, location content in it. But version 13 added the city, state, zip code of the patient, which while isn't likely going to be used for matching, can be used to help determine aspects of the response. So for example, if Medicaid or some other state-based program is at play, that state helps characterize that. And so the response can be consistent with the state the patient's in. And it can also be used to identify, you know, alternative pharmacy locations, for example. So that kind of information in the patient might be useful. And then I guess just to wrap up the patient aspect, looking at what is in the script message versus real-time benefit, neither of them have in-depth, like, you know, condition information or that sort of thing. And what would really be different comparing the real-time benefit 13 and script is that script has former name. It does have a street address, which real-time benefit doesn't have. Alternative contact, gestational age. So some elements which may or may not be, you know, useful or pertinent in this exchange. So those would be things to consider when, you know, further pursuing the idea of expanding the patient content. Just to continue, I guess, highlighting the benefits I see of focusing on real-time benefit 13, some of the scenarios that we identified in the proposed rules really would only be able to be supported using the newer version of real-time benefit. So for example, having information that can support formulary information coming back to the patient. That is something that wasn't in real-time benefit 12, but has been added to 13. Also, many of the systems that will be migrating to a new standard version of real-time benefit are able to provide additional benefit detail or constraint, benefit restriction details at a pharmacy and drug level. And real-time benefit 12 lacks a field that can contain sort of pretext additional details, but that was added to real-time benefit 13. And having done a fair amount of mapping between these different real-time benefit standard or formats, I guess, that are used today, many of them proprietary, that is content that is often very useful and doesn't have a home in the real-time benefit 12 version. So, but 13 does have that. So that'd be another consideration. And then I guess just briefly, an additional point around workflow testing. And I also definitely have heard providers' comments with regard to, you know, workflow considerations, things that are more onerous versus less onerous. I guess my thought to introduce, I guess, into that discussion is that from a certifying standpoint, and I did a fair amount of work helping with some of the initial meaningful use certification with NIST, you know, those processes, because they are conducted, you know, by multiple parties, both in terms of testing entities, but also just individuals who are performing tests, to be most consistently applied across system vendors or systems, is best, I guess, and most reliable if the rules being tested are very objective. You know, if this field is present or if this format is being met, you know, typically they don't go far into kind of user experience, but when they do, it's usually the most, you know, safest, I guess, and gets the most consistent results if that test is still pretty objective. You know, so this information is visible at this step of the process, or a flag is presented in the context of some other information. You know, every tester can kind of gauge that without bringing in sort of additional interpretation. You know, yep, this field is here, I can see it. You know, whether or not it is in an efficient, you know, method of displaying it, or you know, if this would be preferable to something else, we don't have to consider that. I can just answer, yes, this is here. And so by getting into workflow, you know, characteristics, I think it is more difficult to have individuals consistently interpret and, you know, gauge whether or not a system is meeting the criteria. So that's one aspect of a challenge related to workflow testing. Another is that I believe that typically most EHRs and prescribing systems offer a fair amount of configurability that a given customer, you know, or site practice that uses that system has available to them. So, you know, in my practice, I might configure my workflow in a certain way, which is one of, you know, several options that EHR makes available. And so even testing at that EHR, you know, product level, that something is possible doesn't necessarily ensure that each practice, the providers at each practice are going to experience it the same way. So that would just be another consideration when pursuing kind of workflow or user experience tests, is that systems often have a range of options available, and there would still need to be consistent implementation or just choices, which are sort of outside of the control of the EHR vendor. I think that's about the extent of my additional comments.
Uh, Hung, you want to move us along?
So I kind of wanted to summarize to make sure that we captured the information provided from the subject matter experts. What we're gleaning is that it does make sense to use the NDC and RX norm because they're both pervasive, but also because they can be complementary to each other. And that right now, there is ability to display both. And so it wouldn't be a one or the other choice, but that they could actually be used together. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. And then the other is consideration of using version 13 versus version 12, because there is additional functionality and information that's provided, including patient demographic that may assist with matching, and also additional functionalities such as a free text field that may be more user-friendly than what is available in version 12. Is there consensus on that, or is that still an area of debate?
From an NCPDP perspective, it is not an area of debate. It is consensus. We have submitted comments to the CMS proposed rule, and in one of my postings in the chat, I posted a link to that letter, and I believe on page 4, it talks about why you should adopt version 13 versus 12.
This is Shelley from the Pharmacy HIT Collaborative. We would agree with that from the professional standpoint also.
And so this is Frank. One thing to add just with regard to the migration and the different version or the different formats, XML and EDI. Version 13 does still support both the XML and EDI formats. Mm-hmm. And I would agree with Margaret that to aid those that are already on one or the other of those formats, supporting both in certification would be important. And an additional point to that is these implementers will additionally in the next 5 to 10 years or so likely be migrating with NCPDP to a JSON format. And requiring sort of an interim change of format for this version 13, a real-time benefit, you know, to be followed by another format change feels like it would be sort of an extra burden that wouldn't be, you know, beneficial and would just kind of increase their obstacles or steps toward the future. So I think kind of going with the status quo of the choice between XML and EDI at this point might ease, you know, it removes one step on their eventual path toward a more consistent JSON format at NCPDP.
Thank you for that. That was very helpful. If there are no other comments, we can proceed to our next topic.
Hi, should I just jump in?
Yes, please.
All right, thanks. You can run to the next slide. I'll start from there. So good morning, everyone. My name is Alex Contour. Appreciate you guys inviting me here to speak a bit about some of the FHIR-related requests for information that are in HTI-1. Specifically today, I'm going to be talking about the clinical decision support or CDS hooks requests for information. To get us started, I just wanted to do some quick technical level setting for folks that aren't familiar with the CDS hooks implementation guide. I know that we've got a couple of SMEs that are on the line as well, and hopefully they can steer me in the right direction if I do mischaracterize anything with their remarks. But anyway, the CDS hooks implementation guide itself describes the technical interactions between two high-level system actors. One is the system or software that hosts CDS services and actually performs the clinical decision support, and we'll call that the CDS server. And the second is the system or software that actually interacts with the CDS server, requests CDS services, and then consumes the output of any clinical decision support. And I'll call this the CDS client. Both of these actors can actually be functions of the electronic health record, or they could be third-party systems. I tend to think of the client typically as the EHR, and then the server as either a function of the EHR or a third party, but it doesn't particularly matter for our purposes today. So the CDS server will provide CDS services, and it defines these services as hooks. A hook provides some of the basic information about a service, things like the name that the system, the client would use to call the service, where the service might be used in a specific workflow, and then importantly, any information that the service might require as input for making a decision or making a recommendation. And this input in the implementation guide is referred to as context. So during like a clinical workflow, some triggering condition is met. An easy example is a clinician trying to order a medication. When that happens, the CDS client will call the CDS server. It's going to request the appropriate service based on whatever that triggering condition was. I'll note here that the CDS hooks implementation guide does not actually define what these triggers are, and it doesn't require clients or servers to support any specific hooks. It does define a few hooks, but those are sort of more examples than requirements. But anyway, the CDS client is going to be interacting with the server over HTTP, so pretty standard protocols, and it can provide any of the contextual information that the CDS server needs for the service that the client is calling. For example, it can pass like fire resources, so maybe it'll pass a patient resource or some information about the patient. Or it can actually give the CDS server the ability to search for relevant information using the client's FHIR API. Then the CDS server goes and processes any of this contextual information, actually runs the service, and generates a response, which is in the form of what's known as a card, as defined by the implementation guide. These cards are JSON objects, although they're not specifically FHIR resources. Same general format and approach, but they provide information that the client can use to, for example, render on the user interface or the screen to provide some information to the user in clinical decision making. It could do things like provide a set of suggestions or actions that the user can take. It might have links to information resources or information about just sort of how the CDS service kind of derived its recommendations or output. So these cards are returned by the server using HTTP again. And then in some cases, depending on how things are set up, the client might be able to actually respond to indicate to the server what it did with the information that it was given. But again, that kind of depends on how the server is set up and the way it defines its services. So that's really the basic workflow that the CDS hooks implementation guide describes. If you want to move to the next slide, just to summarize at a very high level, the CDS hooks implementation guide describes the RESTful APIs and the interactions to integrate clinical decision support between the CDS clients and CDS services. It standardizes an approach for calling CDS services from within a workflow, as well as for returning output from a service. And it provides a consistent set of capabilities around which CDS developers can design their CDS services. Given what we know about clinical decision support and how it can help address some of the complexities of clinical decision making, and the fact that CDS systems aren't necessarily standardized today, we request information under HTI1 about a few things. One of those is the maturity of the CDS hook standard and whether it's something that we would consider adding in certification criteria for health IT modules to adopt, specifically the CDS hooks implementation guide. And then recognizing that the implementation guide itself doesn't prescribe specific hooks or triggering conditions or things like that, we're also asking for comment about whether there are specific hooks that makes sense to include in any future certification criteria. And then finally, we're looking for general feedback about whether and how the CDS Hooks implementation guide can help improve workflow, reduce provider burden, and then any use cases that we should bear in mind when considering the role of CDS Hooks in future certification criteria. So that's pretty much all I had, short and sweet, and happy to turn it into our discussion session now.
Thank you, Alex.
So this is Hans at some point in time.
Go ahead.
Okay, sorry, I'm only on the phone, so I cannot raise a hand. Apologize for that. I really appreciate the background from Alex and the opportunity. We talked about that within the EHRA community in particular, I think the primary discussion that was there, and curious on others' perspectives as well, is that the CDS hook standard, if you will, is very much maturing. A lot of use starting to be around. But when we and that's quite valid. But when the question comes from, should it be considered for certification, it starts to become a similar question like, should you certify to the base standard or to the implementation guides in the context of the use case. And this will be a good example where how CDS context, what is needed for a particular context, where it fits in the flow, what therefore then the hooks are, and as Alex also indicated, these are examples, is that generally the sense is that where particular workflows, particular capabilities are being looked at to be certifiable, that's the place to then incorporate and include the use of CDS hooks. And you'll see that in the various implementation guides that CDS hooks is being incorporated there. And then there's clear understanding how to use it. If we are only going to focus on certification of the CDS hooks plane, if you will, the base standard, then there's a potential large variety of capabilities that are out there, but not necessarily they're going to hook up in the right context for a particular workflow where it's intended to be used. So prior authorization, appropriate use criteria, others are all the kinds of things where that trigger in ordering, scheduling, whatever, is going to be very helpful. But we need to clearly understand what the data is to be exchanged. So the general sense is a lot of support, interest, and maturation around the CDS hooks itself. But when it comes to certification, the context in which it's supposed to be used is going to be critically important to understand what data, where, which hook, and therefore you know exactly what to do.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, I wasn't sure. It was quiet for a moment, but I disappeared from the air.
Oh, okay. So we do have additional comments or questions in the chat as well. From Mark Savage, are there existing or anticipated patient-facing API uses of CDS hooks?
So this is Bryn Rhodes. I'm a co-chair of CDS and been involved with the CDS specification since the beginning and have been involved in a number of pilot implementations and usage of that specification. The specification itself is designed to support provider interaction, so it's focused on that workflow. But there are uses of CDS hooks that are patient facing. The specification itself doesn't preclude that possibility. It just focuses on the provider support. Yes, there are known uses, but the specification itself needs to focus on that. Regarding the question about will it create a significant number of messages to providers, increasing the number of alerts, that's a concern that has been part of the CDS specification development from the very beginning. That's something that we provide a lot of guidance within the specification about how to ensure that doesn't happen. In addition, institutions are in control, obviously, of the services that they enable for their systems to call out. And the workflow specific nature of CDS hooks ensures that the guidance that you're receiving is relevant to the step of the workflow you're involved in. As Alex noted, the specification does not publish the hook definitions. They're not part of the specification. They are actually separate artifacts. And the way that works is we have a hook maturity model that's very similar to, if you're familiar with fire resource maturity. As Hans was noting, the use cases need to be identified and the data exchanged on those use cases is specific to the hook definition. And so it's part of each hook definition to say exactly what information is exchanged as part of that. And each of those hooks then goes through a hook maturity process. We're currently validating a maturity for patient view, order select, and order sign. And those are the ones that, in addition to the CDS hook specification, we'd recommend calling out those hooks specifically because the use cases need to be identified. And the hook maturity goes through to make sure that there's implementation testing in the same way that the fire specification does with implementation guides.
Whoever's controlling the slide deck, if we can go to the previous slide, please. Excel team, if we can go to the previous slide. Of the CDS hooks presentation, sorry. There were specific questions posed by the ONC team on slide 24 that I'm hoping that we can address. Okay. So if I could have our subject matter experts focus on the request for comments.
Hey, everybody, this is Isaac Vetter. I work at Epic. Along with Brent, I'm a co-chair of the HL7 Clinical Decision Support Working Group, along with the infrastructure and messaging, also chair of the CDS Hooks Project Management Committee. So first, you guys should be looking at version 2 of CDS Hooks, not version 1. That was a recent publication. It's an additional kind of iteration and has some small kind of improvements and medium-sized new features in CDS Hooks STU2 as published by HL7. As Bryn mentioned, we're also kind of actively beginning to work on our first normative release that'll happen sometime probably next year. We talk about specific hooks for implementation. I think both Alex and Bryn, you know, kind of touched on this. So there's a most of the content in the CDS hooks based specification is optional. And as Bryn kind of commented on, the CDS hook specification defines an objective maturity model for evaluating how mature a given hook is. So So like, for example, one of the hooks that is published by HL7 is the order sign hook. The idea is that the EHR can call out to a remote standards-based CDS service at the moment when a clinician is signing an order, for example, prescribing a med. That order sign workflow step is standardized and described by HL7 alongside the CDS hook specification and with the kind of types of information that will always be present when that happens, as well as the types of responses that the external CDS service can provide to help guide that clinician, that prescriber. But, so there's objective maturity model. So I would recommend that the ONC and use that published objective maturity model to help kind of guide what hooks are important, as well as what use cases are valuable. Doubling down on what Han said. So a lot of this requires use case specificity to be implementable. It doesn't make a lot of sense just to say, hey, EHRs support CDS hooks. Rather, we need to be a little bit more specific, both in terms of what features that means, as well as like which should be driven by what use cases we want to enable.
But the standard supports that local specificity, right?
Yes.
Yeah, that's the key point.
Yeah, and then in terms of the actual use cases, I think Hans like also mentioned like referenced the kind of two obvious ones. So that's the DaVinci coverage requirements discovery work. That prior auth coverage determination work is one use case that exists in the industry. The other is appropriate use criteria for imaging orders. In both of those cases, the standards community has already, you know, done some to a lot of work to try to figure out how that could use CDS for hooks and work. Thanks, Pooja. And then any kind of specific questions on that? Otherwise, yeah, Clem. And I think Bryn wants to kind of cover some of the specific feedback that the HL7 Clinical Decision Support Working Group is also drafting to on this RFI as well.
Yeah, I've put some of that in direct chat in response to some of the questions here, and tried to summarize what we're recommending here. But in regard to the question about how this interplays with algorithmic transparency requirements, the CDS working group has had a number of sessions where we've discussed this topic and have prepared some feedback on that. While we applaud the ONC for prioritizing equity in healthcare, prior to mandating national regulation in this area, recommend studies to evaluate the impact of proposed regulations when implemented. The proposed criteria for transparency potentially represent a significant burden on health IT vendors and clinical practices by requiring a significant amount of documentation that isn't typically present or available. So they would then be responsible for producing that documentation when in the, to our knowledge, there's no literature that supports the positive impact of having computer generated reminders with citations and supporting evidence. So it's not clear that there's actually benefit. And we recommend studies in that direction.
Clem, you have your hand up.
Yeah, I strongly support Brian's Burns' suggestion, number one. But it's not clear to me who actually controls the content of the CDS hooks. Is it the receiving physician, or is it the institution? Is it, you know, some godlike creature up above? I mean, because that makes a difference in how they can be tweaked as they cause, if they cause problems.
So, so the CDS hook specification talks about separation of concerns. The content of the decision support rule, logic that it runs in the service, is owned by the CDS service, and they're the ones that determine what the algorithm should be, what data is involved, and how that runs. But the display and workflow interaction of the response of the CDS service is in the purview of the EHR and the implementing system. To address another of the questions about prioritization, the specification, and this is related to that, the specification doesn't automatically prioritize, but it does provide a way for the CDS service to indicate a relative priority of the guidance that it's giving back. And then the EHR, the CDS client, has the responsibility for how that priority is then surfaced in the user interface and the clinical workflow. So the service can say, you know, this is just informational, or versus this is a warning, versus this is a critical alert. And then the user interface and the implementing system have the responsibility for how that is incorporated. And in the implementations of CDS clients we have seen thus far, there's a tremendous amount of care and attention paid to how that is presented to the clinicians to make sure that we're not enabling inadvertently or increasing alert fatigue and provider burden.
I mean, there's a literature about the problems with automatic reminders and the lack of attention or welcomeness of them. In some circumstances, I think something like 15% are actually attended to. So I think we've got to be very conscious of our enthusiasm for computers not ruining the physician's workday.
Mike, you have your hand up?
I will jump in. I'm not sure if this is a question or an observation or a comment for the task force, so bear with me. Most of this area of the rule is focused on pretty technical specifications, which is good and necessary. I do want to make sure that or help encourage ONC, as the final rule gets published, that there be a good explanation as to what this kind of change means for patients. And at the same point, is there information or material within the RFI specifications to support connectivity with the hooks between things other than EHRs, such as patient apps or other components, and have we looped in some of those same types of elements on a patient tool that might be a service offered through a HIT module? Because I could easily see there may be questionnaires or decision support tools that are presented for patients to contribute information, or are we applying the same standards in that space?
So I've personally been involved in several projects related to shared decision making. And CDS hooks as a specification is a component of a shared decision making solution, and could potentially be used to support patient facing decision support in that context. But what we typically see currently is more the use of like existing patient portal functionality to deliver pre-visit questionnaires that then the answers to those questionnaires are available to the patient and physician through Smart on Fire and CDS hooks during the visit. And so there's, you know, it's a component of it, and certainly can be used to help facilitate that shared decision-making.
Right, but I guess what I'm thinking is down the line as we're looking, and as we're looking at further integration of other systems and thinking about social determinants of health and community-based providers and greater data integration. As a patient, I would like to be able to put my information in one place and have it be used where it's needed rather than constantly filling out the same type of data. So I could easily see a CDS module that serves patients' needs that's not quite built into an EHR, but is a third-party tool. Basically the exact same kind of thing that a physician CDS tool would look like, except a different consumer. And just want to kind of think ahead about whether we've got the right support here to support that kind of functionality.
I hate to interrupt, but we need to go to public comment. I think we will have time to revisit your question once we get back from public comment.
Great. Thank you, Hung. We're going to open up our meeting for verbal public comment. If you're on Zoom and would like to make a comment, please use the hand raise function located on the Zoom toolbar at the bottom of your screen. If you're on the phone only, press *9 to raise your hand, and once called upon, press *6 to mute and unmute your lines. So let's pause just for a moment to see if any members of the public raise their hand. Not seeing any hands raised, so we can resume our conversation for the next few minutes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Ike, if you want to continue.
I think it was my kind of question observation, and I'm kind of thinking about, you know, again, task force members or other folks, is this something that we should think about commenting on? And is it relevant?
I mean, I think you make a good point that we want to be able to use CDS to direct the recommendations to any sort of user, you know, nurse, physician, patient, you know, administrative staff, et cetera. But so I think, you know, that's certainly a good idea to craft a recommendation in that regard if our experts feel that makes sense, just given the state of the technology. You know, I also wonder, sort of a question to our SMEs, is CDS hooks also the right tool to use when directing recommendations to software? Let's say, you know, I've got a bot that's sending messages to patients, or, you know, do CDS alerts exclusively go to cognizant human beings, or can they be used in other steps in the workflow?
That's a great question. We did, as part of that STU2 version of CDS hooks, introduce the concept of a background suggestion of we call it a system action. It's seeing some uptake as part of the DaVinci coverage requirements discovery project, where most of the time, or some implementers within that project have really focused on ensuring that the clinician needn't always be interrupted with a card, you know, from a payer system saying that, you know, prior auth it isn't needed, or this big long form needs to be completed. And so and one of the ways that that project is helping to control the cases when the provider is actually, when information is put in front of the provider versus not, is by using this kind of more like recommendation to the system instead of to the actual end user. I think that there's a lot of flexibility, and I think there is real, as Clem was saying, there is real possibility here that a CDS service developer, you know, integrating with a healthcare organization, can the end result of a CDS hooks integration could be increased provider burden based upon alerts and alert fatigue. And the opposite is also true, that, you know, the good use of this standard and these capabilities can also reduce provider burden, put more information in a nice way into the workflow. And that it's entirely dependent upon the use case and the quality of the implementation as to which of those two things actually will happen. And I think that we're learning that even from the DaVinci project.
Stephen, you have your hand up.
Yeah, I just want to say, you know, having been building and using EHRs for well over 20 years now, you know, and having implemented what I think was probably the first CDS implementation within a commercial EHR, you know, 20 years ago, I think so much work has been done at the local level to design and implement and workflow decision support. And certainly the capabilities of different EHR vendors have varied over time. I think one of the real benefits of this functionality is that it allows other market actors to develop and support and maintain CDS that can then be pushed into EHR systems without the need for, you know, either large, well-resourced vendors providing that, or large, well-resourced, you know, providers groups supporting that. You know, you could just subscribe. You know, I love the idea of companies or academic institutions competing on the demonstrable value of their CDS services, and then providers being able to just plug those in. So I see this as a key component of that, and as such, really, really support this going forward.
And we are almost at the hour, and so I think this might be a good time to review our future. sorry, Clem. Clem, you have your hand up.
But I've been muted. Okay, sorry. So I'd just like to reemphasize what others have said, that we really should study the effect of this stuff to see what's good and what's bad and how to tweak it to make it good and what make it bad. And I also have done reminders for many decades in my life, and they're not always happily received. So that's just a final message.
Thank you, Clem. And so just to review our future meeting, we have one last meeting on June 1st as a separate task force worker, where we will be looking at fire subscriptions, RFI. And then after that is our final sprint, where we will be meeting as a full task force to develop the final recommendations and transmittal letters and presentation to HITACH for a final vote in the middle of June. And so I encourage everyone who is interested to attend those meetings and provide your input either through verbal comments or through the chat. And with that, I think we are adjourned. Thank you, everyone.